Patrick Heron's on the line from Dublin. Is that where you are?
I sure am, over here in the Emerald Isle.
And it's a beautiful time of year, I'm sure.
The birds are singing, the flowers are blooming, spring is in the air, and a young man's fancy turns to love.
I love that accent. You were actually born in Dublin, I noticed, according to your bio.
I sure am, yeah. I'm the youngest of 10. Good Irish Catholic family. My mother just died a couple of years ago. She was 93 when she died, and my father was fought in the revolution to try and get the Brits out of Ireland back in 1916.
Well, yeah, you're probably going to have a long life there. You got good genes.
Well, please God, yeah. I just hope I don't have 10 kids, though.
I understand. Let's talk a little bit about this book, and you tell me the name of it again, and tell me why you named it that. It's very intriguing, the title.
Okay, it's called The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse. And the Nephilim, Jerry, is a Hebrew word. It's spelled N-E-P-H-I-L-I-M. And it's a Hebrew word that means the fallen ones. It comes from the Hebrew word nephal, which means to fall. And the Nephilim is the fallen ones. And
well, now this book is soaring up the bestseller list in this country and I guess over there as well. How did you come across the idea about writing this book?
Well, what it is, Jerry, this is my third book. My first book was a bestseller here in Ireland. It was called Apocalypse Soon. And about 5 years ago, I was on holidays with my wife and three beautiful daughters in Turkey. And we were in Ephesus near there and looking at some of the amazing temples and old Greek and Roman cities from a couple of thousand years ago. And we were at a temple called the Temple of Apollo in a place called Didyma. And this looked like a typical Greek temple, except out front of it had these huge columns that you see at the Greek temples. But there was 10 of them across the face, the front door of this temple, and they were 5 deep. So there was 50 of these columns right beside one another, going stretching up 70 feet. And then the temple itself was made out of solid black granite that you couldn't get the blade of a knife between. And I remember saying to my wife and girls, I said, there's no way guys with hammers and chisels built these things. So I had been quite interested in the pyramids and all these other ancient monuments and reading various books like Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock and the Orion Mystery and Chariots of the Gods and stuff like this. And there's been scores, if not hundreds, of books written about the Great Pyramids of Giza and all these other monuments that populate the world, such as Stonehenge, the pyramids in Mexico, the Nazca lines in Peru. There's incredible edifices in Bolivia and in Guatemala, and then out in Easter Island, the big heads with the hats on them, and then over to Angkor Wat in Cambodia. And we've got loads of them here in Ireland as well, the famous Newgrange, and then scores of other stone edifices. But the conclusion that all these esteemed authors come to is that some very advanced race or lost civilization built, for instance, the Great Pyramids. But nobody knows who they were. So what I've done, Jerry, is I've taken a lot of the information that these other esteemed authors have provided, and I've provided the last few bits of the jigsaw puzzle to show who these people were that built them, where they came from, where they got their mathematical knowledge, their astronomical knowledge, the incredible strength to construct these pyramids, where they went, and also their role in our future, because I believe they're coming back.
Yeah, you. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but someone told me that you'd actually solved the riddle.
I believe I've solved the riddle of the pyramid.
Yeah, we'll get into that here in a minute. But
we'll get into that later on, probably. I solved not only who built the pyramids, but why they built it and why they chose the pyramid shape, which is totally unusual shape. Maybe I could just give your listeners a few facts and figures concerning the Great Pyramid.
That would be interesting.
Okay. Because this is phenomenal, and you know, I didn't know this until I went and studied the subject, but the Great Pyramid of Giza is in the dead center of the world. It's exactly halfway between the North Cape of Norway, the Southern Cape of South Africa, the West Coast of Mexico, and the East Coast of China, and it intersects the 30th parallel, both longitude and latitude. The length of the base of each side of the Great Pyramid in cubits is 365.2422 cubits. That's the exact length of a solar year, including the extra fraction for the leap year. Oh. The angle of the slope of the Great Pyramid rises at 10 to 9. That is, for every 10 feet you go up the side of the pyramid, you rise in altitude by 9 feet. And if you take the height of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by 10 to the power of 9, you get 91,840,000, which just happens to be the exact distance from the sun to the earth in miles. There's enough stone in the 6 foot in the Great Pyramid to build a 6 foot wall from New York to Los Angeles. If it were a skyscraper, it would be 42 stories high. That meant for thousands and thousands of years it was by far the highest monument in the world. The solution to the mathematical problem of how to square the circle is incorporated within the geometry of the Great Pyramid of Giza. Yet what we've been asked to believe, Jerry, and what historians and Egyptologists have told us down the years, is that primitive man, or ancient Egyptians, wandering in the desert, dressed in animal skins, somewhere between the Stone Age and the Bronze Age, built this incredible monument, which we couldn't build today, by the way. Yet somehow these same builders and architects had not yet figured out how to invent the wheel. That's why when you see documentaries about the Great Pyramids, you'll always see these slaves dragging these huge blocks along on rafts. So this is totally incongruous. I mean, if you're to believe that, that's like saying if you give a screwdriver to a chimpanzee, he'll be able to build a television set for you.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned some interesting facts there. One of the things that caught my attention immediately, did I understand you to say that the pyramid is located in halfway between the distance of the sun and Mars?
No, it's halfway between in the dead center of the world. It intersects the 30th parallel. But when you multiply the height of the pyramid by 10 to the power of 9, you get 91,840,000, which is the exact distance from the sun to the earth in miles. By the way,
What do you think that means?
What it means is that what these things are telling us is that the builders of this had incredible mathematical knowledge. They had incredible engineering wisdom. They knew where the center of the world was. They knew the exact length of a solar year. Yet, we've been told by historians that the Egyptians built it, but that they hadn't invented the wheel yet. That's just too incongruous.
Yeah, I understand, and we're going to get into a lot of that here in a minute. You've been interested in all of this for a long time. I noticed in your bio that you became fascinated with the end times prophecies several years back, almost 10 years ago.
That's right.
Are the pyramids connected to that?
There is a direct link between the Great Pyramids of Giza and a city described in great detail at the end of the Book of Revelation, which is the Apocalypse. This is the first book ever showing a direct link between these two. We'll get to that later on, because the second half of my book is about the Apocalypse, it's about the prophecies of Revelation. So the Great Pyramid of Giza is portending future events, you might say. By the way, I'd just like to tell your listeners, too, that originally the Great Pyramid was finished in a polished white limestone. So it would have been white and smooth and iridescent, gleaming in the morning sun 5,500 years ago in the dim, distant past, which meant it would have been impossible to surmount. And some legends say that the Pyramidion, that is the top, the peak, pinnacle of the Great Pyramid, was finished in gold. And here's another interesting one, Jerry. Not too far up the road from the Great Pyramid in Lebanon, only 150 or 200 miles away, there's another temple there called the Temple of Jupiter in Baalbek in Lebanon. And this looks like a typical Greek temple, except it's got three huge hewn cut stone foundation blocks, which weigh 800 tons each. Now, to put that in context, that's the same weight as 2.5 jumbo 747s together. And lying out on the ground not far away is another huge cut stone block, which is 1,000 tons weight. That's three jumbo 747s together. Now, we don't have a machine in the world today that could lift that up, bring it over, and put it down again. And our builders would find it very, very difficult to duplicate that temple. Yet again, we're asked to believe, oh, the Greeks built it with their hammers and the chisels, no problem. What I'm saying is that there's something else going on there. And this is what I believe I've answered in my book, The Riddle of the Pyramids.
And in your book, you refer to them as giants, is that right?
Yeah, the word Nephilim is first mentioned in Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, where it says, there were giants, and the Hebrew for giants there is Nephilim, or Nephilim. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them. These became the mighty men which were of old, men of renown. In another version it says these were the heroes of old. So when you get in and study the context of that verse, it talks about these Nephilim, the fallen ones, coming to earth and having sex with ordinary human beings. These are what you and I would call fallen angels, because, as I say, the Nephilim means the fallen ones, because they fell from heaven, fell from grace, and fell to earth. But I don't like the word angel, Jerry, because as soon as I mention the word angel, all your listeners out there listening, the first thing they think of is a little naked cherubim with a bow and arrow and no genitalia, going around trying to shoot somebody in the heart and make them fall in love. Or else they think of some guy with 20-foot wings and a big spotlight behind him, and maybe orchestral music in the background. But when you study the appearance of these angels throughout the whole of Scripture, in fact, a better translation of the word would be messengers or agents. When you study the appearance of these guys, they always appear as men, they look like men, they dress like men, they've been mistaken as men, they eat, they drink, and apparently they can have sex with women. And we're told that these angels came to earth some 3,500 years BC, had sex with ordinary human women, and produced a very evil, violent, wicked, evil offspring, which were great in size. And this is where you got all your Greek and Roman and Egyptian mythology from. The gods came down from heaven. They lived in Mount Olympus and Delphi. Zeus came down. He took Alcmene to wife, and she almost died giving birth to Hercules. That's where all this mythology comes from. Now, again, people might say, oh, well, that's just mythology and legend. But any historian will tell you that mythology has its basis and its genesis in truth and fact. It's just that the stories have been distorted somewhat as they've come down through the generations.
Now, when we're talking about pyramids, and you mentioned the Giza pyramid, but what about those pyramids in Mexico? Is there a connection there?
There absolutely is a connection. That's why another reason I say, people say, of course the Egyptians built the pyramids, and say, well, if they did, they must have jumped in boats and sailed over to Mexico and did some moonlighting over there and built the pyramids over there, because they're like exact replicas and almost as impossible for us to build today. And a lot of them have astronomical alignments as well. In fact, the Great Pyramid of Giza has two star shafts on the north face and on the south face, pointing at four distinct star signs: Draco, Orion, Sirius, and Beta Ursa Minor. And I've identified three of these stars with gods, that's with a small g, which are mentioned either in the scriptures or in Greek or Roman or Egyptian mythology. And yet again, the pyramids in Mexico, and not just there, but a lot of these buildings around the world have astronomical connections and alignments.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and people have drawn those conclusions before. But you've really gone into great depth about it here in your books. And I say books because you've been writing about this sort of thing for a while now.
Well, my first book was a bestseller here in Ireland. It was called Apocalypse Soon. My second book did okay, but this one is a really radical book published in the United States. And by the way, it's getting rave reviews over there. I'm getting fantastic responses from people who are reading it. I got an email from a guy a couple of days ago who said he has read it three times in a row. Another guy said he couldn't put it down. He read it in 4 hours, a guy yesterday. It's pretty, pretty radical, and it's amazing. It's the first book ever of this type. By the way, these guys, these Nephilim, these fallen spirit men, by the way, that's what they are. They're men, but they're spirit men. That's what...
Now, what do you mean by spirit men?
Well, we don't know what spirit is, Jerry. You and I are flesh and blood.
Yeah.
You know, but these guys are spirit, whatever that is. And they're not constrained by the ordinary laws of physics as we are. That's why they can sort of disappear from here to wherever heaven is. I mean, heaven, I believe, is outside our dimension. It's in another cosmos, I think, outside the time bubble that we're in. So they can travel these distances very, very fast. But these guys were knocking around for anything up to 1,000 years prior to the flood of Noah. And they so infected the whole human race with their evil and their violence and their sin and the murder and the stuff that was going on there, that Yahweh, or God, wiped the whole lot out in the flood. He wiped out all the human beings. He wiped out their progeny, these giants. And the only people that were saved through it was Noah and his family. But you can't drown spirit men. So we're told that these spirit men are locked up in a subterranean prison, which has many names in Scripture. It's called the Abyss. It's called the Pit of the Abyss. It's called Gloomy Dungeons. It's called a prison. And once in the New Testament, it's called Tartarus, or Tartarus. And this, of course, ties in with the Tartarus of Greek mythology, where we're told that the gods were imprisoned because they rebelled against Zeus. And it ties in with the underworld and the abode of the dead of Greek mythology and the Egyptian Book of the Dead, where again we're told that, you know, you have to cross the river Styx and Hades is the keeper of the underworld. So, and also, which is a very, very interesting thing, in the New Testament it speaks of the Messiah. In his risen body, it said he went and preached to these guys. He appeared, descended into the lower parts of the earth and visited these guys in prison, and it says he preached to them. But the word preach there is caruso in the Greek, which means he heralded his triumph over them. And this is the same word that would be used when, for instance, say a Roman general came back to Rome from a far-flung campaign, and he displayed his treasures and his trophies and the slaves that he'd captured there, and he heralds his triumph over the enemy in front of the citizens of Rome. This is the same word where it says the Messiah appeared to these guys, and I suppose he said, look guys, I'm up from the dead, you know, all your plans have come to nothing, your goose is cooked, I'll be back, or words to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the dark forces that you're talking about that reigned here for 1,000 years, or at least had their way. What are we talking about when we talk about dark forces and we say they're evil? What do we really mean here? I mean, you know, there's evil and there's evil. Were they just bad boys or worse than that? What were they doing?
They're pretty bad. These would be a certain amount of what we would call the fallen angels that rebelled with Lucifer. It says when Lucifer fell, he tried to rebel, tried to usurp the throne of Yahweh and take over. And he brought a third of the spirit beings with him, a third of these spirit men that we call angels rebelled with him. But these particular guys, and that's in the spirit realm, right? We can't see them, but just because they're invisible, they don't appear to people all the time, doesn't mean that they ain't there. But the ones that actually come into concretion and that had sex with women, it seems like that once they came into the physical realm and became manifest in the physical realm and were able to have relations with women, they couldn't go back there. We're told in the New Testament that they left their first estate and they couldn't go back there because they had shed whatever that spiritual dimension is. But there's still a terrible lot of these evil guys knocking around. They're going to become manifest in the future. We'll talk about that in the second half of the show. But there was a second eruption of these fallen angels again after the flood of Noah. Right? The first guys that caused the evil before the flood are locked up in this subterranean prison called Tartarus. But it happened a second time. And you might remember, some of your listeners might remember the time when the children of Israel were led out of captivity in Egypt. And Moses sent 12 spies into the promised land to spy out the land. And when they came back, 10 of them says, look, there's no way we can take this land. We saw the Nephilim there. We saw the sons of Anak, which come of the Nephilim. They said, we look like grasshoppers compared to them because they were all giants. And then they wanted to kill Moses and Joshua and those guys because they wanted to go in. So they wandered in the desert because of their unbelief for 40 years. But later on, under the leadership of Joshua, they went into the promised land. They defeated these giants. It were told that they captured 60 of the giant cities of Bashan, and they killed Og, the king of Bashan, and were given the measurements of his iron bed. And it's something like 8 cubits long and 4 cubits wide, which translates into about 18.5 feet long and about 8.5 feet wide, this bed was.
So we're really talking about a giant.
The offspring of the Nephilim were giants. They were very great in size. And as I say in the book, Jerry, how would you like to wake up in the morning with this guy beside you in the bed? He's a big mama.
Yeah.
Maybe he's one of the guys. These are the guys that your team out in Oklahoma need playing on their football team.
Yeah, right. don't tell them. They'll be trying to recruit them. Let's talk a little bit about the offsprings here. They obviously had sex with women. So and then they became more or less human at that point. They couldn't go back to the spirit world. How about the offsprings? Were they as mean as the others?
Oh, they absolutely, because it was genetically in there, and they're irredeemable. These guys, and that's why they contaminated the whole world with their evil and violence back there. And it says that it was so bad back prior to the flood. It says that there was only evil in men's hearts always. All they were doing was you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, murder. It was out of control, big time. And the same the second time round. When Joshua killed a lot of these giants, it says some of them escaped to Ashdod and Giza and Gaza and some other place. And then a couple of hundred years later, you'll remember when David was fighting against a guy called Goliath. Goliath was the offspring. He was the descendant of these guys. And when you work out the measurements that it gives you for him again, he was around 13 and a half feet tall, probably 400 or 500 pounds. Again, he was a big mama. And it says they killed a few of them there. And in my book, I have some pictures of images from Egypt, from the temples in Egypt, which show a lot of these pharaohs or gods. And invariably, you'll see pictures of them. And these are all over the place in Egypt because I was there. You'll see one of these guys, and they're twice the size of ordinary human beings. And one of them will be there. He'll have maybe five Nubian slaves by the hair in one hand, and then his other right hand is up in the air with a sword in it, and he's ready to start to chop the heads off the five of them all at the one time. And when you look at these pictures, it's obvious that these are almost like photographs or replicas of what happened back then, because there's no way it's just sort of showing these people to be big. By the way, we've a huge history of them even here in Ireland, all over the place. It's mentioned several times in ancient Irish history about the giants being here. We had a famous Balor, the one-eyed giant in the Battle of Moytura. I have a lovely little cottage on the west coast of Ireland up the hill overlooking the sea. It's a beautiful place, a little salmon river nearby, beautiful golden beaches. If you ever come over to Ireland, Jerry, you're welcome to go there for a few days.
Hey, great.
I'll buy you a few pints of Guinness.
Sounds good.
But about a half a mile away from my cottage, there's a heap of stones, and it's known locally as the grave of the giant. There's a lot of... These guys were knocking around, and in England, it's Brutus. Britain is named after Brutus, who was supposed to be the last giant that was killed there. Then you have in Norway, you have Thor, and... You know, so there's a lot of information and historical information about these guys knocking around the place.
Well, when we talk about evil, we're talking about just not what we would declare as moral behavior. We're talking like chopping people's heads off and grinding them up and things like that without any...
According to the Book of Enoch, there was a fellow called Enoch, and he wrote a book called The Book of Enoch, which very, very few people know anything about. I only read it, discovered it when I was writing this book. And the only reason I give this, Enoch was the seventh in descendants from Adam. He was the father of Methuselah, I think, who was the father of Noah. And there's only two or three verses about him in Genesis chapter 6, and then it says he was taken. He didn't die. But he wrote this book, and the book of Jude in the New Testament, which is the one just before the book of Revelation, it's a very small, short letter. It's only one page. And Jude was the brother of Jesus Christ, or the half-brother of the Messiah. He would have been one of the sons of Mary and Joseph. And he quotes directly from this book of Enoch. So that means we can give it a lot of credence. And he fills in a lot of the blanks that you don't find in the Old Testament scriptures. And he said these guys were into unbelievable things, that they taught men how to make stars, they taught them about roots, they taught them about witchcraft, about aborting children, and it says that they were so evil, that murdering people, that they began drinking their blood. That's how bad it got. They were into cannibalism. It was evil. Very, very, very evil. And, you know, when you want to get into the second half of the book and talk about the apocalypse, Jerry.
Yes, I want to, here in a minute.
Okay, well, these guys are coming back. They're going to be knocking around again.
I can hardly wait.
Well, I'll put it to you like this, Jerry, and I would like to say this to all your listeners, too. There's a lot of good news in this book, right? People think the apocalypse is very, very bad and it's all doom and gloom. Well, it is to a degree, but I suppose I'd put it to you like this, and I'd like to address this to all your listeners, too, with regard to the coming apocalypse. Suppose for a moment it was 1912, and they met you and your family walking down the pier in Southampton, and you had tickets to go to this new land of hope and glory and milk and honey, and I stopped you and I said, "Sir, madam, don't get on that boat, it's going to sink." And you say, "Sink? What do you mean, sink, Paddy? This boat can't sink, it's unsinkable." And I said, "Well, I have the proof," and I pulled out the video Titanic. Well, my book is a little bit like that. I don't have a video, but I've got a book of evidence. And what I show clearly in this, displaying and showing the prophecies of the Messiah about the future, the coming apocalypse, is that, if I can use that metaphor, the bad news is the Titanic is going down, but the good news is you don't have to get on it. There's a way out, there's an escape route, there's an alternative, and that's what I show in the book.
And when you say a way out, an alternative, are you talking about individually or for the human race itself?
You know, it can only happen on an individual basis. What I do in this book, Jerry, it's a bit like if I pulled you in off the street and I pointed at your producer who was in the dock in the court, and I said, this guy is guilty of murder. Is he innocent or he's convicted of murder? Is he guilty or innocent? And you'd say, well, I don't know. I haven't heard the evidence. For the most part, people haven't heard the evidence about this stuff. So what I do is I provide enough evidence for people so that they can come to an informed verdict when they read all the evidence, and then decide whether they want to get off the Titanic or go down on the Titanic.
Would you describe your book as a religious philosophical book or what?
I'm not religious at all.
Okay.
I am a Christian, but I don't attend any particular church. I drink pints of Guinness. I smoke the odd cigarette. I've even been known to break wind occasionally. So I'm a peculiar sort of Christian, Jerry.
You're pretty normal. But
I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. Mm-hmm. And I think probably the same could be said for the Messiah. And, you know, the Messiah was a cool guy. If he was around today, he'd be wearing jeans and a T-shirt. The people who were always hassling him and trying to trip him up, and who organized his kangaroo court, his betrayal, his torture, and his ultimate murder, were the chief priests, the Pharisees, and the doctors of the law. That is, the guys that stand in the pulpits every week with the long frocks and the tall hats.
Yeah, it sounds like, in fact, I had a discussion with one of my producers today about this, that this world today we're in is almost like it was back then.
Nothing has changed. The French have a saying, they say, plus ça change, plus c'est les mêmes choses. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Nothing has changed. He was a cool guy. And, you know, most Christian people, and there's a lot of Christian people in the United States, and I've been there. I lived nearly 3 years in the States. I met a lot of these.
Yeah, I notice you have a degree from the College of Biblical Research there in Indiana.
That's right. And I have a degree from Trinity College, an MA and a BSc.
Well, that's the reason I ask you about the religious question.
Well, the point I'm making is that I would say I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. See, there's a difference.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, but I am a Christian. And you know, there's a lot of Christians. There are a lot of great Christians all over the world and in the United States that are just regular folks, you know. They're not all right-wing, fundamentalist, Bible-thumping, you know, nutcases who are out in the woods in Wisconsin armed with AK-47s, you know. A lot of us are just regular people. And what I want to do is, because when I was a young fella, Jerry, I was raised in the Roman Catholic Church. I had all that beaten into me from the age of four. I was an altar boy. I went to the Christian Brothers who knocked seven shades of you-know-what out of me. But by the time I got to about 15, I decided it was all a load of rubbish. And then I sort of went to college. I got into a bit of sex, drugs, rock and roll. At one time, believe it or not, I hitchhiked from California to Pennsylvania.
Well, you probably came right through Oklahoma.
I drove by Oklahoma in 1974. I could see it over on my right, and that was the second summer. I was in the States in 73 and 74, and the second year I was there, I just had all these incredible, weird experiences happening to me that eventually led me to where I am today. And one of them was driving by Oklahoma. I was on the way down to Tucson, Arizona, with two other guys. I was driving. They were asleep. I was driving down the highway. I could look over and see Oklahoma a few miles over to my right-hand side. It was raining, lashing rain. In fact, it was coming down like a cow whizzing on a flat rock.
It does that.
The car just went into a spin, and it did 180 degrees for no reason at all and went down towards the side, and I just turned the wheel, and it sort of reversed down. If I hadn't done that, the thing would have flipped and turned over a few times. And it was weird, and I had the weirdest experiences over there that summer. But all those things led me to where I am today, because I met some people. A lot of weird things happened, as I say. I won't get into them now. I met some Christians, old hippies, guys that were involved in the Haight-Ashbury thing and LSD and stuff in the 60s, who'd become Christians. They gave me a Bible. I came home. I started reading it. It meant nothing to me, because I used to read voraciously as a young fellow, and I want to say, well, I've read the Bible. And about a year later, I was reading it, and that night I had a Saul on the road to Damascus epiphany. Now, I didn't go blind and fall off a horse, but it wasn't too far behind it. And it just changed my life around, and that was without going to any church or anything. And now here I am, almost 30 years later, and I've written this incredible book, which is changing a lot of people's lives.
Now, what can we do? You said that it's not hopeless.
Oh, absolutely not hopeless. Well, maybe we should talk about the second half of the book now.
Yeah, I think so. It would be a good idea.
All right.
And I have some questions, too, later on, but go ahead.
No problem. The second half of the book the first half of the book is a thesis and an in-depth study on these Nephilim. Again, let me spell it for your readers. It's N-E-L-I-M. By the way, if people want to buy it, they can get it on Amazon.com if they punch in Nephilim, N-E-P-H-I-L-I-M, or my name, which is Pat.
Yeah, we have a link over there so people can find it.
Yeah, and they can get it in Barnes & Noble as well, or there's a free phone number. I'll give that quickly, too.
Yeah, please do for our radio listeners.
Pardon?
Yeah, do it for our radio listeners. Give the phone number.
866-909-BOOK. That's 866-909-2665. And you can call that 24/7. It costs $13.99, but it's very cheap on Amazon. It's only $10.49 on Amazon, I think. And as I say, you can get it in Barnes & Noble. And if they don't have it on the shelves in Barnes & Noble, then they will get it for you within 24 hours. Or if you want to buy it from yours truly, you can go into my website, which is www.nephilimapocalypse.com.
Yeah, interesting website, and we have a link to that too.
Okay. Well, that's right. We'll steam on here. The second half of my book is a summary of the prophecies of the book of Revelation and of the signs we are told that would precede this coming apocalypse. Now, what people need to understand about the scriptures, about Bible prophecy, is about 25% around that of the Bible is prophetic. In other words, it's telling you things that are going to happen before they do, so that the veracity is borne out by the fulfillment of the prophecy, or else if it's not fulfilled, then it's proved to be a load of rubbish and you can throw it in the bin and go off and read the Quran or something like that. But when the Messiah was on earth, now many of your listeners will probably have seen that movie, The Passion of the Christ.
Yes.
And in that movie, in the last 24 hours of the Messiah's life, 25 specific prophecies came to pass, which were all written from 500 to 1000 BC. For instance, it was prophesied that he'd be betrayed by a friend, that he'd be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, that his friend would commit suicide, that they would use the 30 pieces of silver to buy the potter's field, that he would be crucified with thieves and robbers, that they would stick his spear into his side and blood and water would come out, that they would gamble over a seamless robe, etc., etc. 25 specific things were fulfilled in that man in one 24-hour period, which is just unbelievable. In fact, in his short ministry, he fulfilled 109 specific prophecies. So that's how you can sort of realize that this stuff is on the ball. And when they asked him in Matthew 24 and Luke 21 and Mark 13, they asked him, some of his closest confidants came to him and asked him privately, they said, what will be the signs of the end of this age and of your coming? The second coming they were talking about. So he said, this is what he said in a nutshell. He said, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. Nation shall rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. And the Greek word for kingdom there is ethnos, both ethnos. Another one ethnic group against another ethnic group. You have Jew, Arab, Hutu, Tutsi, Serb, Croat, Protestant, Catholic, Arab, Jew, Arab, Christian, you know. That's the thing. He said, nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom. He said there'll be an increase in famines, in earthquakes, in peculiar weather, in immorality and lawlessness, in corruption in high places, in people's hearts and love growing cold. He said the wind and the sea raging. In fact, in Luke 21, it says, the nations being in anxiety and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the waves. Now, we saw an incredible example of that with that tsunami, which was just after Christmas there. The nations in anxiety and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the waves. And I was discussing this with a friend of mine just before Christmas. We were talking about a verse which is written in the book of Revelation. And this is what it says. I'll read it to you now. In the book of Revelation, it talks about these judgments that are going to be poured out. There's seven vials, seven trumpets, and seven seals that are opened. But it says here, the second trumpet, it says, and the angel sounded a second trumpet, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood, and the third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. That's what it says. Now, I don't know if you know, Jerry, but since that tsunami in Asia, a lot of the scientists have been talking about this active volcano in the Canary Islands called La Palma. Have you heard about that?
Yes, just a little bit. You might flush that out.
Okay, well, basically what they're saying is it's not a matter of if this thing is...
But when?
And they say when it goes, it could cause a tsunami 500 feet high that travels at the speed of a passenger jet, which means it would take about 9 hours to reach the east coast of the United States of America. And when it hits the east coast, it could be anything from 25 to 60 yards high. Now, we saw the damage that tsunami did out in Indonesia and Banda Aceh and around there. And it was only 10 yards, 15 yards high. Not even that. They're talking about something that could be anywhere from 25 to 60 yards high. And one Irish minister was out there, and when he came back, he was speaking about it. And he said he was in one place in Indonesia where he saw two quite large trawlers, on top of one another. And they were 3 miles inland. And it says, in this thing again, it says, there's a huge mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and a third part of the ships were destroyed. So all of a sudden, you'd imagine what something that high could do to a third of the ships which are in the sea. And that is to come in the future. So that's one of the things that are prophesied in the book of Revelation. But just talking about the signs about the end again, the wars, famines, earthquakes, diseases, peculiar weather. A lot of your listeners will say, I know what they're thinking right now. They're saying, we've always seen these wars, famines, earthquakes, diseases. But there's one sign which is incontrovertible, and you can't argue with it. And that's with regard to the Jewish people. There was scores of prophecies that said the Jews would be kicked out of Palestine and Israel, that they would be scattered to the four corners of the earth, and that everywhere they'd go, they would be despised and persecuted and hated of all nations. And in 70 AD, a Roman general called Titus went in to put down an insurrection in Jerusalem. He slaughtered about 1 million Jews. The rest were scattered to the four corners of the world, hence the wandering Jew. Everywhere those people have gone, they've been hated and despised and persecuted, which culminated in the Holocaust in Germany in the Second World War. But there's dozens of other prophecies that said in the last days and in the last generation that God would regather Israel again and establish them in Palestine. And he would do this as a sign to the rest of the world that we were in the last throw of the dice. And in 1948, Israel was recognized as a state for the first time since their 2,000-year worldwide scattering. Now there's 5.5 million of them there. World peace is contingent upon what happens in that neck of the woods between the Jews and the Arabs. So when people go home tonight and switch on their television and they see more trouble in Israel, they see another suicide bomb or the Palestinians shooting or the Jews shooting Palestinians, we are watching that prophecy coming to pass. We are that generation.
So in other words, you feel the end times might be fairly close.
I believe the writing is on the wall. These are what I call the shadows of the apocalypse. The hoofbeats of the four horsemen of the apocalypse are clearly to be heard by all those that have ears to hear. Jerry, the world is a time bomb whose fuse has long since been lit. That's the bad news. The bad news is the Titanic is going down. The good news is we don't have to be part of it. We don't have to be there. By the way, when I said to you earlier that these Nephilim are coming back, let me just tell you that in Revelation chapter 9, it's this Tartarus or abyss where these guys are imprisoned that caused the wickedness and the evil and the destruction in the days of Noah. And in Revelation chapter 9 it says, this abyss is going to be opened and these guys are going to be released again. And it says that these guys have a king over them. He's called the king of the angel of the abyss. And it says his name in the Hebrew is Abaddon, A-B-A-D-D-O-N. And his name in the Greek is Apollyon, A-P-O-L-L-Y-O-N. And it means the destroyer or destruction, and it says he goes to his destruction because he is the one who becomes what is known as the Antichrist, and by the end of his term, something like half the population of the world is wiped out dead, which is about 3 billion people in today's terms. But Apollyon, Jerry, A-P-O-L-L-Y-O-N, is nothing only how the Greeks spell what we would call Apollo, A-P-O-L-L-O, And of course, Apollo in Greek mythology, he was one of the main leaders of the pantheon of the Greek gods, along with Mercury, Mars, Saturn, Hera, Athena, way back when. This is who these guys were. And Apollo, he was known as the epitome of the beauty of man, of prophecy, of music, of athleticism, etc., etc. And this is the guy that goes on to be this great political leader in the future, who's going to deceive the world with his lying signs and wonders, and going to go off and end, which ends up invariably in a place called the Valley of Megiddo in northern Israel. And that's where you get your the word Armageddon from. But as I say, the bad news is the Titanic's going down. The good news is you don't have to be there. There's a way out. There's an alternative. That's what I show in my book, The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse.
And this way out, you're refusing to say it's actually religious, right?
Well, it's spiritual.
Okay.
It's spiritual. Basically, it says anybody who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved from the wrath to come. That's what it says. And as I said, I'm not a religious person, Jerry. I don't know about you, but I am spiritual. You know, and I'll drink a few beers with you, and I'll have a laugh with you. But I'm a spiritual person, and I think there's a lot of ordinary people out there that are like that. Religion sort of turns people off a lot. And I know, I mean, Ireland is full of religious people, but there's very few Catholics or Christians here. All you've got to do is go to the north of Ireland and see that. They're all supposed to be Christians, and they were all murdering one another for years. And the same has been going on in the world for donkeys.
Well, yeah, you look around everywhere. A lot of things are being done in the name of Christianity, which is pretty bad, in my opinion.
The Lord said, you're getting in the end times. He didn't say things were going to get better and you're going to have peace and brotherhood of man and goodwill and all that. He said you're going to have wars, famines, earthquakes, diseases. And when you see these things, he said it's going to be like a woman in travail, like a woman in labor pains. And of course, as your women listeners will know, that when you're in labor, the closer it gets to the birth, the more intense the pains come, the closer together they come, until basically there's a rebirth. And this world is going to go through that, and the apocalypse is going to be the bloody rebirth, but then it's going to be reborn into paradise regained. But the, as I say, the good news is you don't have to be there for what's coming down the line.
Now when we talk about, and we started out on the pyramids, You're insinuating, or maybe you're just flat out saying, that they were built by a superior race, not the human race.
There is no way that these incredible monuments were built by ordinary primitive man. Engineers today freely admit that there's no way we could build the Great Pyramid of Giza. We couldn't afford it for a start. We couldn't do it. So no, the ancient monuments were not built by primitive man.
So who?
They were built by the primeval gods of prehistory, not a bunch of mythological characters.
But who were these people?
These were the Nephilim. These were these fallen spirits.
And they came from other planets or what?
That's what I'd like to tell you now. I'd like to show you the direct link from between these men and this future city that I talked about. Yes, they came from this, what I would call a parallel universe. It's called in scripture heaven, right? I call it a parallel universe. And in the second last chapter of the book of Revelation, in chapter 21, it talks about the next heaven and the next earth, the future heaven and earth that is to come when all this rubbish is done away with and we're finished with it. And it describes this city that's going to descend out of heaven and land on this new earth. And it describes this city in great detail. It's called the New Jerusalem. And it tells us all the different stones it's made out of. It tells us the thickness of the walls. It says it's got 12 gates, 3 on each side, made out of a single pearl each. It says the river of life is going to flow out of it, etc., etc., etc. And at the end of this description, Jerry, it gives us the dimensions of this future city. And it says the length and the breadth and the height are the same, pyramid in shape. So there's a direct link between this future pyramid city called the New Jerusalem, described in great detail in chapter 28, and between the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt, built some 5,500 years ago. What you could say is that the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt is pointing forward at this future pyramid city, and this future pyramid city is pointing back at the...
Well, you know, it's almost like a riddle. I mean, are we repeating, or is it circular? You know, I mean, what's happening here exactly?
With witnessing to the other one. And this is what I say when I say that I've, now the riddle of the pyramid is solved, at last the riddle of the pyramid solved. This future pyramid city gives the answer to the riddle as to why the pyramids were built in the first place. Let me just fill you in a little bit more before I give you the answer to that. You will probably will have remembered this statement. In my father's house are many mansions. You've heard that?
Sure, sure.
Okay, the Messiah said that one time. He said, in my father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. So he was said he was going to this house of many mansions to prepare a place for us. And then he ascended and he went up through the heavens to a place called heaven. And he's up there now with his sleeves rolled up. He's mixing cement. You know, he's preparing a place for people. Then later on in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, it talks about Abraham. And it said Abraham looked for a city in the heavens whose builder and maker was God. And later on then, Paul wrote about a house in heaven, and he said, we have an eternal house in the heavens whose architect was God, and it was not made by human hands. Now, this is the place they were talking to. And when the Messiah said, in my father's house are many mansions, this is what he was talking about. He was talking about this place he was going to. And we're told that he went through the heavens, that he's sitting down on the right hand of this other man called, we call him God. It says they're surrounded by 24 thrones. Sitting on these 24 thrones are 24 elders. We don't know who those guys are, and an innumerable amount of these spirit men, called, we call them angels, these spirit men. And literally, this is what heaven is. This is this parallel universe. That's where the Messiah is now. He's not dead. He wasn't buried in a hole. He didn't run off and marry Magdalene, by the way, and have a bunch of kids. And in my father's house are many mansions, I go to you. And this is where these Nephilim, these fallen angels, fell from. And when they fell to earth, back in the dim, distant past, they built this incredible pyramid with all the mathematics that it involves, with the astronomical alignments, with the incredible engineerings, with the shafts that point at the four stars. Just this amazing building with the smooth, white, iridescent finish on the pyramidian top. It just must have been gleaming when they built it back there. And they built this as an earthly representation of a celestial reality. And they built it as a monument which replicated the city that they had come from. And as I say, in my book, I tell you why they built it. But in order to find out the riddle of the pyramids, you're going to have to read the book.
Now, you literally are saying you believe there's 24 thrones around God.
That's right. That's what we're told.
You take it that they're really talking about thrones.
It says there's 24 thrones, and these 24 elders are sitting.
And you take it that Yahweh or God or whomever you want to refer to him as is sitting there on the throne.
Yeah, but he's got a bigger one than the rest of them. He's the main man. And remember, Jerry, it says four times in Genesis, it says, "Let us make man in our image. In the image of God made he man." So we look like them, except that their spirit, we are flesh and blood, whatever that is. And the Messiah, in his risen body, it says he had a new spiritual body. But still he said to doubting Thomas, he said, "Come, stick your hand."
So when you say they fell from heaven, are you saying they just fell from heaven, or did they get here in a ship, or how'd that happen?
Well, I think because they're spirit men, they're not constrained. They don't need, maybe they did come in ships, I don't know. But I don't think that they can transcend, for instance, the speed of light, because they're spirit. And when the Lord went back there, when he ascended back there, it says he went through the heavens. You're talking millions of light years. But, I suppose it's a bit like Beam Me Up, Scotty, or something like that in Star Wars, that they're outside the physical laws that we are constrained by because we're flesh and blood. And as I say, the Messiah in his risen body, he could disappear in and out through walls. He could descend to the lower parts of the earth and appear before these guys. But he still ate in his risen body. He ate fish, he ate bread. And he still said to Thomas, "Look, stick your fingers into the holes of my hands. I'm not a ghost."
And the evil giants, when they come back, where they're locked in this subterranean place, you literally believe they're in the bowels of the earth?
That's what it says. And it says in a couple of places in
well, none of that seems to be scientifically possible.
Truth sometimes is stranger than fiction, Jerry. And when you get in and you look at the mathematical accuracy of the prophecies and the way they've been fulfilled, you'll realize that this is exactly what's going to happen. I mean, it's not scientifically possible for primitive men wandering in the desert in animal skins to be able to build a great pyramid. And yet still not able.
Well, I agree with that, but it's just as logical that they were built by some other race that came here and they were wiped out by some natural disaster. And then another thing recycled, and now we're getting ready to go into another period of destruction. And Mother Earth replenishes itself. That's just as logical.
I totally agree with you. And this is laid out. Remember, these are the prophecies of the Messiah, of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, you know. These are not my prognostications. I just put them together for...
You know, they got them right.
Well...
You know, the Bible's been through lots of translations. King James beheaded a lot of people. The Old Testament, as you refer to, and you depend on a lot of things there to back up your arguments. How do you know those things are even correct?
Well, I'll tell you how. As I mentioned earlier a little while, when I talked about prophecy... The veracity is either borne out or it's proven false by their non-fulfillment. And one guy, one scholar, a fellow called Grant Jeffrey in America, he took 11 of these prophecies written about the Messiah. And what he did, Jerry, is he assigned probability to them. For instance, it says in Micah 5:2 that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. So he said, now hold on, Bethlehem was just a Mickey Mouse little village in the backwater of the Roman Empire. Messiahs aren't, or kings are not born there. There was thousands of villages there at the time, but we'll say we'll make that 200 to 1 that he's born in this place called Bethlehem. Then he took another one, and it said that the king, the Messiah, would ride into Jerusalem on an ass's colt. Now, kings don't go around riding on asses. They ride big steeds, white steeds. But he said that's very unlikely.
You're misunderstanding what I'm saying, because I'm not picking apart whether or not Jesus lived, whether or not Jesus was here, or any of that. But I do quarrel with the fact that people are taking it literally.
Well, let me just finish my point here.
Okay.
I won't take a minute.
Okay.
They assigned probability that he'd ride in on an ass at 50 to 1. So the combined probability of both those prophecies coming to pass was 200 by 50, which is 10,000 to 1. And he took 11 of these prophecies, and he assigned fairly conservative probabilities to them, and probabilities are scientific, by the way. And when he multiplied them all out, he said the probability of all these, of just these 11 coming to pass in one man's life, were a billion, were 10 billion to the power of a billion. And he said, to put that in context, that's a bit like me saying, if I took a ring from your finger, Jerry, and I went up in an airplane and I sailed around the seven oceans of the world, and somewhere I opened the window and I threw it out, then I came back down and I gave you a boat and a fishing rod and I said, off you go, Jerry. When you feel lucky, stop, and you've one chance to let your hook down and locate where your ring is. That was the same probability of those 11, just those 11 prophecies coming to pass in this one man's life. Now, he fulfilled at least 109 specific prophecies.
Yeah, well, I'm not arguing that fact. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Noah and the flood, Adam and Eve. How the earth, the creationism theory, to me, it just doesn't seem to hold any water. Pardon the pun.
Well, do you think evolution is more sensible?
Sure. And in fact, Genesis, you know, it talks about the beginning of the earth. There was nothing, then there was water, then the things came up. I mean, it's identical. And basically, when you get to the Adam and Eve, that could be Yahweh's chosen people. And Yahweh, you know, there's two references in the Old Testament about God, Yahweh and also Jehovah. And now, hey, we could be talking about two different people.
I don't think so.
Why don't you think so?
Why do you think?
Mankind has to have one superior being and has to be one.
Well, actually, the Bible says that there's two main gods. It says one is Yahweh, the true God, the high God, and it says the other one is called the God of this world, also known as Lucifer, the devil, Satan, Baal, Beelzebub, the deceiver, the prince.
You really think there's a prince of evil?
Absolutely. And all you've got to do is look at the evil in the world to realize
Well, I mean, why would that have to be a prince of evil? Why couldn't that just be a normal man's behavior of reacting to things, and they don't. You know, I believe the New Testament Bible is giving one lesson that nobody pays any attention to, and that's basically unrequited love, agape love, going forward, and we don't follow that. We don't follow that at all.
The reason we don't is because that the God of this world is the guy who's pulling the strings here. Remember when he took the Messiah up on the mountain to deceive him, and it said he showed him all the glories of the world in a moment of time, which takes a lot of power to do that. And he said to him, all this power and authority will I give you, for it is delivered unto me, and to whomsoever I will, I give it. Now, I'm wearing a shirt here, Jerry. I couldn't give you this shirt if I didn't have it. He is the one with the power and authority.
You meet salesmen every day. You meet salesmen every day that tell you they're going to give you things they can't. I mean, that's no proof.
Well, the Messiah didn't call his bluff because he knew he was in charge. And it says he's the one with the power of death and destruction and sickness.
Well,
that's why the place is in such a mess.
Yeah, we only got a couple of minutes left, Patrick. How do we save ourselves?
Well, I believe anybody.
Are you saying you have to be born again? Is that what you're saying?
Basically, that's what the Lord said. Unless a man is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. And basically, that's just believing in Him. That's not running up and down.
Let me ask you something.
Or carrying crosses or beating yourself up. The problem is, Jerry, that most people just haven't heard enough.
How do you explain the similarity of all these religions? You're talking about spiritualism earlier. How do you explain the similarity? They all seem to have a lot of similar things.
Well, I mean, the guy that's one of the names for Lucifer is the deceiver, and he's out to deceive you. And if I was trying to slip you a counterfeit $50 note, Jerry, then I'd want to make it look a little bit like the real thing, or else I wouldn't be able to trick you, would I?
Well, it's been, with that, I'll let you close the show. And the book's very interesting, a great read. People need to get it. And I've enjoyed talking to you all the way from
here. All right, listen, Jerry, can I quickly tell them what it's called again?
Yes, please.
It's called the Nephilim, Nephilim, by Patrick Heron, Heron. And if you pipe them into Amazon, it comes up. Or you can call free phone 866-909-2665. 866-909-2665. Or you can get it at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, I've enjoyed the conversation. We'll have to do it again.
Thank you very much for having me on, Jerry.
Okay,
God bless
you.
Enjoyed
it. Bye.
Bye-bye.